Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello? How are you today?
Much better, thanks.
Good. All symptoms of that frustration complex disappear?
Completely.
Splendid. Watch you don't overdo it. And keep taking those pills.
I will.
And remember, if you get another attack of egotism, don't wait. Go back to the hospital immediately.
I don't like to bother people.
No bother. Enjoy yourself.
Thank you.
Back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The NHS is not for sale, say the slogans, but is it being privatised anyway? Laura Treasure and Sarah Pinch at the publicly funded University Bristol Hospitals Trust haven't returned my phone calls this week, inviting Bristol NHS on to explain the changes tonight. But we are joined by a patient advocate and also by a retired doctor to check up on how our healthcare is being affected by Andrew Lansley's changes. Well, it uncovered a Masonic lodge, a criminal one at the heart of Britain's justice system, and exposed corruption in Scotland Yard's anti-terrorist squad and in Downing Street. Yet thousands of these phone hacking related crimes have so far gone unpunished, and most of the crooks are still in their taxpayer funded jobs. To add insult to injury, the public inquiry into the scandal is being run by a judge who parties with and accepts favours from the happy couple Matthew Freud and Elizabeth Murdoch, the heirs to the Murdoch empire. So we hear what investigative journalist Michael Gillard thinks is at the heart of the phone hacking problem. As the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks in the US approaches, what really happened that day? Did the media spike stories that didn't fit in with their preferred version of events? We hear from a senior US Marine Corps veteran and former head of the US Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, about who he thinks carried out the 9/11 attacks and, more importantly, why. So, first to the future of arguably the feather in Britain's cap, for which we're still envied around the world, which appears to be being privatised by stealth. Our healthcare and the political context, because none of the proposed privatisation was in the Conservative or Lib Dem manifesto. Was it, Martin?
You're asking me? No.
Yes, I am, Martin.
The answer is no.
Yes. So, how can a government get away with making such massive changes to the National Health Service when actually none of this was proposed before the elections?
Well, they can try. Maybe they won't. I mean, they've already had this pause where they said they were going to look at it. And I think that they're getting lots of advice from professionals and others, patient advocates and others, saying, well, you need to rethink this. But whether they'll take any notice, we'll have to see.
But isn't there some sort of contract between the voters and the politicians where we vote for something and we get it?
No. As you well know, it's caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. If people believed David Cameron when he said that the NHS was safe in his hands and there would be no top-down reorganisation, then there isn't. He can do what he likes as long as he's Prime Minister. But of course, the voters will have the last laugh.
But surely, I mean, he sounds more like a con man than a legitimate politician.
Look, let's not throw around silly names at each other. Let's just stick to the facts. He did say, it's quite clear in the election campaign, and I think, speaking on a wider spectrum, I think David Cameron convinced the electorate that he was not a madcap free marketeer, that he was a new kind of old kind of conservative, that things like the NHS were basically going to be allowed to carry on pretty much as they were with a bit of tinkering, but he's clearly not doing that, the government isn't doing that, and we'll have to see how it plays out. But I mean, I'm not convinced with any of the things that they're saying that are going to work. A lot of them are actually going to cost more money rather than less, like a lot of the other policies they've come forward with. We'll see how it plays out. But of course, when you've broken something like the NHS, it takes decades to fix it. You know, and what about the old Conservative slogan, if it ain't broke, don't fix it? They're causing a lot of problems for themselves by pushing this forward. They could have avoided all of this aggro by just leaving things pretty much as they were and then just listening to professional advice. But that's up to them, isn't it?
Well, although they were invited twice this week, no representatives of the university's Bristol NHS Trust have come to put their side of the changes. I made a direct telephone invite through their public relations staff, Laura Treasure and Sarah Pinch. So if any NHS staff would like to contact this programme directly, just email tony@bcfm.org.uk or call the station and I'll personally guarantee your anonymity if you fear bullying or dismissal by the Trust. So I'm joined this evening by two people, one on the phone and one here in the studio. First of all, in the studio, patient advocate Daphne Habercroft. Hi Daphne, welcome.
Hello,
to Drive
Tony.
Time. Yes, you've been in before. Can you just remind us, what is a patient advocate?
Well, it's somebody who's been a patient and has experiences so they can put forward arguments in the interests of patients.
Okay, and what have you been up to recently?
Well, what I've been up to recently is trying to get our good friends at University Hospitals Bristol NHS Foundation Trust, and isn't that a mouthful, to agree to holding a public forum for people, patients and members of the public, who are rather unhappy about the way the histopathology inquiry was conducted and the outcome of it.
Okay, so can you just explain what histopathology is and what happened with this inquiry?
Okay, histopathology is where, if you have suspected disease, a pathologist in a laboratory, and there are currently two main ones in the city of Bristol, look at specimens of your tissue under a microscope and do certain tests, chemical tests to it, to ascertain whether you've got disease or not, and if you have disease, what sort of disease it is, so it helps inform the treatment plan for you. And the issue goes back to, it actually goes back to the year 2000, but it all emerged in June 2009 when Private Eye exposed allegations from North Bristol Trust doctors that pathologists at University Hospitals Bristol had been making some errors that had harmed patients. And so there was what the Trust called an independent inquiry.
Can you just give us an idea of what those errors were, what sort of errors they were that were harming patients?
People who were diagnosed with benign conditions that turned out to be cancer, people who had been told that they had a particular grade of cancer, like grade one, and then on review by North Bristol it turned out to be grade three. So errors are made, but it's how you deal with the errors and how frequently they occur that is the key thing.
Because what I was going to say at that point is, surely, I mean, there is a kind of margin of error in any of this histopathology type of work, and in fact almost all medical work, there has to be some kind of margin of error.
Indeed, there is, and because it relies on human beings looking under microscopes and doing tests, I don't think anybody would argue that errors will not be made. But these errors were made going back to the year 2000. Doctors at North Bristol raised concerns about them, and it appears they were not taken seriously. So both trusts, North Bristol and University Hospitals Bristol, have clinical governance procedures, pages of the things, because I've obtained them under Freedom of Information, and in them it tells you what you should do if you suspect that there might be some errors. First of all, you keep the patients informed, which wasn't the case here, and also you look into them and find out whether they're substantiated or not as a sort of learning experience. You don't just pretend they don't exist.
That's a bit worrying, isn't it, that even patients aren't being informed when the Trust actually knows that there are errors in their diagnosis?
Yeah, and what happened with the histopathology inquiry is that they investigated 26 cases of misdiagnosis in this inquiry. And the patients affected, or their relatives, if the patients were dead, were not informed of the existence of the inquiry until just before the final report was published in December last year. So those patients and relatives had no opportunity to give evidence to the inquiry panel, or indeed to seek their own independent clinical opinions.
Well, that's quite worrying, because it sounds to me as if certainly somewhere within the Trust there are managerial levels where their concern is far more to protect their own job.
Indeed.
And their own reputation than it is to protect the public.
Indeed, and actually the code of conduct for NHS managers is very clear that the top one is to make patient safety their first concern. And the issue with the histopathology inquiry is that, certainly my opinion and that of other people, is that there's been a lot of effort into protecting senior managers and also some senior doctors who knew that these things were going on, and not actually establishing the facts and investigating them and finding out why governance procedures were not followed and why it all led to this inquiry.
Certainly a lack of transparency, and it's a pity that nobody could come along today to explain that. Anyway, thank you for being very, very patient on the line there. Chris Burns-Cox, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, Chris, you're a former doctor. Can you just explain to us what you did whilst you were working in the NHS, Chris?
Well, I ended up as a clinical director for medicine at French Air Hospital. And I was developed a number of departments over the time I was there, and one or two projects that involved the whole of Bristol. So I was just a hospital physician, basically, but incredibly keen on the National Health Service.
And what's your reaction to what you've heard from Daphne there? Do you think that this is something which has changed over the years? Do you think that there is a more of a culture of keeping these things under the belt of the trust rather than dealing with them and being open and accountable?
Well, it has happened before, hasn't it? Particularly in Bristol, as we know, with the Bristol Children's Heart operation business. That was kept quiet for a very long time before that scandal was exposed. So I think there's a much greater risk of this becoming a common thing with the system that Mr. Lansley wishes to impose on the National Health Service. Because if there's going to be competition between hospitals, then obviously they're going to be much more tempted to tell lies and to deceive rather than being open and sharing.
But you say this, Chris, they'd also be much more tempted to deliver a much cheaper service, won't they?
Cheaper service. They won't have the money to provide even the service that they provide at the moment. What with the PFI payments and the way the government has organised foundation trusts, in that they will run out of money, which means that the service then GPs won't have enough money to pay the hospital to do all the treatments that they do at the moment.
So can you tell us, what you've been up to just the last couple of days? So I know you're still quite active amongst various groups.
Yeah, I was at a meeting of the NHS Consultants Association, which is a group of 700 consultants who are devoted to the principles of the national and the preservation of the National Health Service. They're nothing to do with terms and conditions and pay and luxuries for consultants. It's entirely the NHS. So we liaise with people like the BMA and ministers and shadow ministers and organisations to try to fight the corner of the National Health Service. So yesterday we had a meeting in London, and there is some interesting news. I mean, just recently the BMA has come out absolutely solidly. They've said they are not going to accept the current NHS and social care bill as it is. They reject it wholesale. Now, they had said before they weren't happy, but they were going to go on talking, but now they've actually said they're going to reject it. They have rejected. So that's very good news.
Well, is that maybe not just an emotional response, seeing the NHS under threat, or is there any kind of real substance? Why did they say that?
Oh, but because they've begun to realise what a complete disaster it is for the National Health Service in Britain.
So can you explain why, in your view, why you think that the changes that the Health Secretary Andrew Lansley is trying to bring in are just simply not going to work?
Oh, well, for one thing, they're so complicated nobody can see how they're going to work. The cost of running the service, already it's about £10 billion a year spent on managing the internal market that was started by Mrs. Thatcher and Mr. Clark, Kenneth Clark, that was unfortunately allowed to grow with the Labour, new Labour.
Can you just explain how that internal market works?
Well, it means that GPs and hospitals are commissioned to provide so much care, and providing by the PCT, the Primary Care Trust. And so it is a market, because a Primary Care Trust can say, right, we want to buy our service from Southmead, or we want to buy our service from Bath. And so then the hospitals then have got to say, right, we can provide this and that service of this and that cost.
So maybe the reason for that, surely, is just to get trying to get a bit of a more control over budgets, because you can't just have these primary care trusts just spending whatever they want, wherever they want.
Well, they haven't got enough money to spend and all the things they want to spend anyway. So, I mean, that sounds reasonable enough, but it's not. It's just not going to work.
Okay.
Now, what the big thing Lansley wants to do is to open up all businesses, all aspects of the health service to competition. And the competition has to be on a level playing field between the National Health Service unit providing it, as we know it traditionally, and a private company. And there are a lot of these very big companies like United Health and Healthcare and Netcare, and they come from South Africa, the United States, Europe, and one or two of them are even English, who are throwing their hats in the ring to compete for they'll make a good juicy amount of money out of the National Health Service. So they will, the GPs, so-called, they won't actually be doing it, but the GPs will have to employ professional commissioners, who will be other privately funded people, to then commission the services that the GP's patients need. And the services will then increasingly go to private companies. Now, the duty of a private company is to maximize its profits for its shareholders. That is its duty. It's not to provide the best possible quality of health care. It is to provide the maximum profit for its shareholders. So you can see what's going to happen. They will squeeze, the quality of care will go down, and they will squeeze the care available. They'll cancel a lot of things that they don't feel need doing, and people will then have to have their own, we'll have to take out our own health insurance if we want to get our hip replaced or our knee replaced or whatever it is. We'll have to take out our own health insurance because these companies won't have the money to pay for the treatment.
Just on the subject of the NHS competing with other providers, I'm involved in a review of pathology services at the moment that's going on in Bristol. So the NHS is looking to consolidate pathology services. It's part of a directive coming down from from the Department of Health. But it's interesting because one of the things that I've asked NHS Bristol, the PCT commissioners, is, have you got a business case for doing this? You know, your budget, your business plan, etc. And they haven't. And so my view would be, actually, that potentially puts them at a disadvantage in competing with private providers if they don't have a business case for doing basic changes.
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, the government, I think it's a chap called Miller, set up this program that they should amalgamate pathology services. It could be really frightful if they were able to do it quickly. It won't be so bad in Bristol when Frenchay moves into Southmead, and so we only have two main hospitals. But at the moment, it would be a disaster. We're going to have to go back to pigeons carrying blood specimens from one hospital to another for speed. If you try to drive from Frenchay to Southmead to the laboratory in the rush hour, I mean, you know, if you want an urgent blood sample or blood cross-matching or whatever, no, it's ludicrous.
Another thing with the pathology services review is that the Department of Health, Dr. Ian Barnes, who's the national pathology lead, put out a paper to the Strategic Health Authorities in June 2010. And in it, he said, consolidation of pathology services should not be at the expense of quality and safety. Current quality and safety should be maintained. So one of the things that I and other members of this group have been asking the NHS is, okay, what are your current standards of quality and safety? But they don't have that information.
No.
So it's rather worrying when you consider that NHS Bristol is commissioning pathology services, but apparently has no idea of the quality and safety of the services they're actually commissioning, which leads me to think, well, actually, maybe that is partly to explain why we had a histopathology inquiry in Bristol, because there were no published standards that the commissioners were holding the trust to account to deliver to.
Well, it doesn't say much for the commissioners, does it, apart from anything else? They've been commissioning the services in the three hospitals for years. Why haven't they insisted on this? They should be demanding standards, shouldn't they?
Absolutely.
And Chris, one thing that bothers me, though, is at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter who is actually delivering that service when we get our service from the NHS. If it's someone who's able to do it cheaply and efficiently, as many of these private firms can, what is going to be the actual difference for us as patients at the end of the day?
Well, But it costs more if you put things out to tender to, and the services of private companies looking for profits is going to cost more. So you get, for every £1 million spent, you'll get less service.
But if that's the case, then surely none of these private companies are going to win any contracts.
Well, they'll put in false quotes, put in sweeteners in their quotations, and then as soon as they've got started, they'll screw things down. I mean, the whole thing is designed to do that with the concept of foundation trust. The whole thing is designed to end up with a shortage of money. The money's got to come from somewhere. Mr. Lansley, who's a traitor to the National Health Service, an obvious traitor, completely. Mr. Lansley is not going to give it. So where's it going to come from? It's going to come from the shareholders and companies who will then get a grip on controlling the way the health service is not only provided but run.
There's a big job for procurement, isn't there, of these future services? And I think one of the questions in my mind is, are the groups, organisations who'll be procuring these services from what's termed any willing provider, will they have the nous to be able to make sure that they really make sure that these bidders step up to the plate?
Well, the commissioning people will be employed by groups of GPs, but they will be business people, and they will bring in external wisdom and experience from the States and other places like South Africa.
Well, that's funny you should say that, Chris, because, of course, the chairman of UBHT, the Health Trust, John Savage, who, it's a shame, he's not been able to come on the programme for whatever reason. I think he's away on holiday. He also says that he's not able to speak on the subject, even though he's the chair of the NHS. He's also the former head of the South West business representatives, that is the South West Chamber of Commerce, Business West. So there seems to be quite a lot of connections between a lot of the chief people running the NHS locally.
Absolutely.
And the business community.
Any level anywhere near Whitehall, in this sort of inverted commas top levels of officers in the NHS, and they've nearly all got business connections. And once they've got to an elevated place in the NHS, then they go back into the business. Loads of people.
But what's the problem with that? Surely business people are very good at making organisations work efficiently.
They're very good at running organisations whose sole purpose is to make a profit, which is quite different to what the health service is. Collaborative in principle. We collaborate with each other. We don't try and do each other down. It's collaboration, not... There's a degree of competition for morale purposes, I think, but it's collaboration is the key, which is what we've got to considerable extent at the moment. And once we've lost that, I don't think we'll ever get it back, because the European law won't allow it. It's no longer any willing provider, it's now any qualified provider, which is another trick that Lansley has played to try and confuse us. Legally, it's exactly the same value.
It's interesting that Dr. Savage's name has come up, because, yes, he's the chair of University Hospitals Bristol. He actually knew about the histopathology issues in June 2008 when he was copied on a letter. But the question that we've been asking the Trust and have not got a satisfactory answer is, well, why didn't Dr. Savage actually do anything about it to make sure that the concerns were properly investigated? And as a result of it, his Trust ended up spending £720,000 on this inquiry, which a lot of local people are still unhappy about.
Yes, oh dear, that's a very sad story, isn't it? Well, thank goodness there's people like you, Daphne. Let's hope you can get a larger group of people to press and insist on the truth coming out. One of the good, reasonable things that's come out of the current, or in the current bill, health service bill, is that board meetings have to be, of foundation trusts, have to be open to the public. That wasn't in there before. They could have been kept in private, but now they say they've got to be open to the public. Another big problem coming in with these outside companies is fraud. When you look at the record of these companies in the States, the same company, just looking to make a bigger income over here, these companies, a lot of them have been in court for really big fraud, millions and millions of dollars. And at the same time, when they're still in court, they're taken on for various things over here in the NHS. It's already happening. So fraud is going to be a big thing. So you're going to have a big bureaucracy. You're going to employ a lot of lawyers and a lot of accountants. So you're going to waste an awful lot of money on what I regard as parasites, dare I say it.
Okay, well,
actually any help to patients.
Thanks ever so much, Chris Burns Cox, joining us there from Gloucestershire and a former doctor at French A Hospital. And I'll give the final word to you, Daphne. Can you just tell us a little bit about your patient advocacy and if people are interested, how they can get involved as patient advocates?
Well, the NHS is doing a lot of service reconfigurations at the moment in Bristol. I mentioned the pathology services review, which is looking at the future of pathology services. And NHS Bristol, the commissioners, do have a website where they invite people to get involved. It's called the Healthy Futures Programme, so people can find it on their website and sign up if they want to get involved. But I do recommend that anybody who does want to get involved, that they do really make sure that they hold the NHS to account, not to pull the wool over their eyes.
OK, Daphne, thanks ever so much for coming
in again.
Talking to us about our healthcare future.
Thank you.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, it uncovered a criminal Masonic lodge at the heart of the criminal justice system and exposed corruption in Scotland Yard's anti-terrorist squad and Downing Street. Yet thousands of these phone hacking related crimes are so far unpunished. Most of the crooks are still in their taxpayer funded jobs. Operation Wheating is looking into all that right now. But the public inquiry into the scandal is being rubbed by a judge who parties with and accepts favours from the heir to the Murdoch empire. We hear what investigative journalist Michael Gillard, who now works at the Sunday Times, thinks is at the heart of the problem.
I mean, the history of journalism is a history of spiked stories, but not every spiked story is a conspiracy to prevent the public understanding what went on. But clearly, backdoor communications between the Yard at the highest level and the Guardian at the highest level did have a bearing on the closing down of our inquiry.
But how can the police put pressure on the editor of a newspaper to stop them publishing? You would have thought that it would be in the newspaper's interest to get this stuff out there and increase their circulation, no matter what the story is.
Well, I think that what we're seeing now in the current News of the World scandal is that if it bleeds, it leads is an expression around crime stories, and crime is a very profitable thing for both newspapers, media organisations and police forces to be in a relationship with and over, and that determines how newspapers behave and how the Metropolitan Police in this instance are portrayed. There is a cosy arrangement between crime reporters and the police through this body called the Crime Reporters Association, which is effectively the mechanism through which some stories see the light of day and others are buried. For example, the sexual peccadilloes of leading police officers in the Met, many of which are known to these crime reporters but actually not known to the public, because the deal is that they don't report on it in return for stories from the Yard's casebook.
Now, I don't imagine you've been surprised over the last few weeks on the phone hacking scandal, but I mean, what can we learn and what have you learned from what's happened over the last few weeks?
I think the most significant revelation is that a senior reporter at the News of the World is a registered informant to the Metropolitan Police. I mean, that undermines the entire basis of the relationship between journalism and those upon whom they're supposed to report. And it also raises the fundamental questions, well, if it was Neville Selbeck, who was the reporter in question being registered informant, and which other reporters at the News of the World or any other newspaper have a similar relationship with the police?
One of the other revelations is that there are rather a lot of employees in the press office at the Metropolitan Police are former News International employees. In fact, some of these still working for News International. Did that come as a surprise for you?
I don't think there's any surprise in the revolving door between media organisations and Britain's biggest police force, because clearly, these relationships are established while the coppers are coppers, and then when they leave, in the case of people like Andy Hayman under a cloud, they want to look for alternative employment, and quite often, being someone who can pontificate on crime is a good thing for newspapers to have. So I don't find that surprising. I think the level of the more secret contacts between senior Yard officers and News of the World executives in terms of the dinners and lunches and drinks during a time when they're investigating those newspapers is obviously the more problematic thing. in the same way that there should be a rethink about the relationship between journalists and politicians through the lobby system, there should be a, you know, a rethink in terms of the relationship between crime correspondents and police through the Crime Reporters Association.
Can you see anything that you'd like to see done in order to make sure that the press are able to report impartially on the police, even when the police are corrupt?
Well, I mean, I think you first have to get rid of the Crime Reporters Association, because that is the mechanism through which all these secret briefings and corrupt relationships can exist. I think that also the Met historically has been very intolerant towards dealing with journalists outside of the Crime Reporters Association, and what they do is they nominate their favoured sons and daughters on the national media, through whom they give the big crime scoops. And in return, who knows what's given? We now know from the situation of Neville Feldberg that some journalists are even offering to be registered informants in return for stories. I think that it deserves a separate inquiry in and of itself of how many reporters on Fleet Street or in broadcasting are in fact registered informants, Scotland Yard or any other police force.
Well, I mean, what is the problem about the police actually getting anybody that they feel is appropriate to be an informant, you know, if they believe that that's going to help in the solving of crime?
Well, a journalist has an obligation to the public interest, and his or her duties are to informing the public first, not being an agent of the state. If you're an agent of the state, then you have duties and responsibilities to those who pay your way, i.e. the police, and not to the public. And that's the obvious conflict of interest in what Neville Feldberg and whoever else are doing by agreeing to be registered informants.
Why do you think it's taken something like 7 years after the original investigation into Glenn Mulcair, the private investigator who was doing this work for the News and the World, and possibly others too, to actually reach the House of Commons, the Home Affairs Select Committee, and the public? That's a long time for a scandal to be sort of just brewing away behind the scenes.
I think there's plenty of other scandals. One in particular, the 1987 axe murder of Daniel Morgan, the private investigator, that has been a festering sore in the Met for 24 years, which they still haven't solved, which touches on all the issues that the phone hacking scandal touched on, and many more, and goes far higher up and spreads far wider. And yet, unlike phone hacking, which is now the subject, as you pointed out, of a public inquiry and many other inquiries, the Daniel Morgan murder is still being prevented from being aerated through a public inquiry, despite the efforts of the family to persuade the current Home Secretary that she should do so.
That was Michael Gillard, who's we're now working for the Sunday Times, and who, along with Laurie Flynn, wrote the book in 2004, Untouchables: Dirty Cops, Bent Justice and Racism in Scotland Yard, of which only 5,000 hardback copies were made, now going for quite a lot of money second-hand on the internet. Michael Gillard there.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, on the 10th anniversary of the September the 11th attacks in the US, as it looms, what really happened that day? Did the media spike stories that didn't fit in with their preferred version of events? We hear from a senior US Marine Corps veteran and former head of the US Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Alan Zabrowski, about who he thinks carried out the 9/11 attacks, and more importantly, why.
I began to have suspicions about what had happened on 9/11. About 2 weeks after the attacks, there were several discontinuities that made no sense to me whatsoever. The behavior on the part of some of the named terrorists, these 19 Arabs on four planes, running around flying schools like loose cannon, not having the pilot skills to fly the aircraft, no recognition for what they had done afterwards in their own area, their own community. And it struck me that for many reasons, none of the arguments that were being given for what they did made any sense. But I then immediately forgot about it until about 2 years ago. And then I came across a video which I found to be extremely disturbing. That video was an interview with a Dutch demolitions expert named Danny Jawenko. It concerned the collapse of the third World Trade Center tower to go down on September 11th. This was the 47-story World Trade Center 7, the third tallest building at the World Trade Center. Jermanko had never heard of it. Neither had I. And when you looked at the building, you saw that there was effectively no damage to any face of the building. It had not been hit by a plane. It had not taken major trauma from debris. And it went straight down into its own footprint in about 7 seconds in what was visibly a controlled demolition. And it was pretty clear that whatever those 19 named Arabs on four planes, two of them at the World Trade Center, had or had not done, they could not have had any possible effect on that third building going down. Shortly after that, I came across, partly out of my own curiosity, in a very extensive video, both of which I've cited, by the way, in some of my recent articles, which were taken on 9/11 itself from what became Ground Zero, the base of World Trade Center 1 and 2, the Twin Towers, involving police, emergency services personnel, newspaper and television correspondents. And you can see and hear secondary explosions at the base of the World Trade Center buildings. Now, planes impacting at 800 to 1,000 feet above the ground are not going to cause secondary explosions at the ground floor. And this followed over into other reports also there on September 11th about vans in the area, white vans. In one case, a van was picked up by police and people arrested at the access to a major bridge. The van was filled with explosives, and the two people in it were Israelis. In Bergen, New Jersey, same day, a van with several people in it had set up cameras. Before the first plane hit, they were filming the Twin Towers, and they were celebrating. High fives. It was a good thing for them. Residents called police. Police arrested them. All five were Israelis. What intrigued me, in addition to angering me, was that within days, all of these reports disappeared from the media. Most Americans don't know that a third building went down at the World Trade Center. Most have never heard about the secondary explosions reported by CNN, ABC, Fox, and others at the foundation of World Trade Center 1 and 2. None have ever heard about the vans. So I began looking at this very carefully, and one of the things that I began looking at was just what would it have taken for a special operations group of any particular nationality to have done 9/11, either by having taken control of the operation we have been told about, of the 19 named Arabs on four planes, or having run a parallel operation where you have four planes being hijacked, but there is another operation being done with those in concert. And I picked up three particular factors that would need to be taken into account. One was motivation, a second was expertise, and the third, the critical one, was access. Now, when it came to motivation, it's probably a very sad commentary on where we are in the world today, that there are an awful lot of countries and groups out there in the world that have either real or contrived reasons to hate America. It wasn't that way when I was a young man, but then many things weren't the same way now as they were when I was a young man. But almost all of the groups and countries that might want to do this only had a negative reason for doing it. They wanted to hurt us. The Israelis had a positive reason, and it's one that a number of their supporters had talked about from the 1990s on up, and what was called the Project for a New American Century, whose members included, by the way, later Vice President Richard Cheney, later Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and many of the so-called neoconservatives, most of them Jewish but not all, who came into the first Bush administration. Israel had a positive reason, and was get the United States involved in a war in the Middle East with a powerful, enraged anti-Islamic strain within the American public, that they needed a catalytic event to produce this. They even talked about it in terms of another Pearl Harbor is needed to bring the American people into this fight. The second was expertise. Lots of expertise out there. Bringing buildings down and controlled demolitions is something that almost any intelligence agency of any country in the world can do or can contract. There are many private agencies that do this. But one thing is absolutely clear. Neither those 19 named Arabs on the plane nor Al-Qaeda as an organization had the expertise, the technical expertise to do that. And there is one very clear proof of that. If Al-Qaeda and its affiliates had had the ability to wire even one building for a controlled demolition at the World Trade Center, much less all three of them, the so-called green zone in the heart of Baghdad would have been a pile of rubble. And it wasn't. But the last is access. The World Trade Center security was an Israeli-owned company. Security at all three of the airports from which the four aircraft on 9/11 departed, ICTS, was an Israeli security company. That security company, by the way, also had security at the airports in Paris and Amsterdam later, from which the so-called shoe and underwear bombers departed. The security company at the World Trade Center had 24/7 state-of-the-art electronic surveillance and foot patrols. Wiring a building for a controlled demolition, and I must confess here, this is not my specialty. I have heard what people who do this for a living have said about it, but it is not my specialty. But the description of it in the video of Danny Jawenko that I mentioned to you is a very good one on this. And he described it in which if you needed to do it in a few hours, you would need 30 to 40 people, fewer if you had more time, cutting open the walls, literally cutting open the walls all the way around the building, implanting the explosives, running detonator cord and cable, wires to put them to a control system, coordinating all of this activity. This is not something that involves the casual bringing in of a briefcase and leaving it at the foot of a building's elevator and going out again. This is extensive work. And it would require the type of extensive, sustained access that could not go unremarked by the security forces in place on this. They also needed the ability to evade apprehension and to have their escape concealed. And they had that done. All of the Israelis who were apprehended in those vans were later released in about 2 months at the direction of Michael Chertoff, then the second director of Homeland Security, a dual U.S.-Israeli national. There is no mention of them in the mainstream media, which is largely Zionist-owned, all of the major networks, all of the major national newspapers, all three of the weekly news magazines, all of the major political journals, most of the major publishing houses. It simply didn't happen. The only thing that happened on 9/11 that was discussed in the media, that would have been accepted by the government, that was described in the 9/11 Commission, are 19 named Arabs on four planes bringing down two buildings. And the rest of it, in Orwellian terms, has become a non-event and a non-story.
That was the first of our clips tonight from Alan Sobroski, who's a former veteran of the United States Marine Corps, and also, more interestingly, was for several years the head of studies at the United States Army War College, which is in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Now, Martin Summers is still with me here. Martin, you know, who is Alan Sobroski to tell us that it's potentially the Israelis being behind the September 11th attacks?
Well, one of the things that wasn't made clear in the clip, and people ought to understand, is that Alan Sobroski is himself Jewish. So he's a Jewish American officer. As I understand it, he was a US Marine colonel, served in Vietnam, and then was so senior that he was put in charge of training the US Army officers at the US Army War College. So you can hear the logical way in which he approached the whole problem. There's a lot of information there for people who they probably haven't heard before. As he pointed out, most people haven't heard that three buildings went down on the day. But if you check WTC7, just put it into your computer, and you will see the video of the third building coming down. And now when people see that for the first time, it often shocks them, because they say, well, why didn't anybody tell us about this before? And this is the whole point that Zabrowski's making. He's analysing it as a military operation, and he's pointing the finger directly at Israel as the culprits. Now, I've got an open mind about this. I think they must have had help from inside the US security forces, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to do it. Another senior military officer who's pointed out, well, I'll give you two other senior military officers in the world who've also said that it was an inside job. One is General Leonid Ivashov, I-V-A-S-H-O-V. He was Commander-in-Chief Russian Armed Forces on the day. And the other is Mohammad Gul, G-U-L, who was former head of the ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, the Pakistani CIA. Now, these are three senior officers, one Russian, one Pakistani, one American. It was an inside job, probably the Israelis. These are senior officers, military officers. They don't mess about. When they say what they're talking about, they say what they mean. But have you heard about this on Radio 4? No, you heard it first on Bristol Community Radio.
The other thing which I find quite surprising about that is that there's these private Israeli security companies running so many of these
Absolutely.
Airports.
They were running Schiphol Airport, where the underpants bomber was taken onto the plane without being checked by security. That's because the security is run by CTSC, which is the same Israeli company.
It's actually ICTS.
ICTS, sorry. Corrected. But the fact of the matter is that for those who use the internet and read the international press, this is well known around the world. The former head of the Russian Armed Forces is saying, as far as I'm concerned, that was an Israeli-American inside job. Has anybody told the British public that, other than ourselves and other similar organisations? No. The BBC that we were talking about earlier, Leslie said it had a left-wing bias. That makes me laugh, because they've said nothing at all about any of this and have tried to ridicule those who've pointed out what everybody in the rest of the world has been saying for ages.
But many people will think of Alan Zabrowski as a conspiracy theorist. So how does he answer that charge?
I don't think that's so much of a conspiracy theory. To tell a bit of a story on this, back in the early 80s, when I was in Washington at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, one of our visitors for a luncheon talk was a young gentleman then named François Heisberg. Heisberg was the special assistant to French President François Mitterrand. I don't know how this subject came up, but he said, you know, Americans never see conspiracies anywhere. We French, he said, we see conspiracies everywhere. And both of us are wrong. This is not a conspiracy in the sense that it is usually used, the word is usually used, which is to denigrate an opposing argument. When someone in the United States says that that's a conspiracy or that's a conspiracy theory, by definition, they mean it is irrational, illegitimate, and without proof. All I would suggest to people is that you look at the films of WTC7, that third tower going down on September 11th. You look and listen to the reports on September 11th with the secondary explosions. These are not fantasies. They happened. You look at the reports on September 12th of the apprehension of Israelis with vans of explosives and cameras filming the events on September 11th. These are not fantasies. And you look at the people riddling the American government, all of the Middle East people in State Defense and the National Security Council, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith, who used to be a friend of mine, by the way, from Philadelphia. These people were all part of the neoconservative movement. Many of these people are dual U.S. Israeli nationals. All of their primary allegiance is to Israel.
Is that correct, Martin, that there's so many people in the U.S. government who, as Zabrowski there is saying, is their primary allegiance is elsewhere?
Well, that's I listen very carefully to people of his seniority. And, of course, he is a strategic analyst. That's why he was head of studies at the U.S. Army War College. Think General MacArthur. Think, you know, think of people of that kind of caliber. They are trained to analyse these events. He's analysed these events and he's come to his conclusions. I listen with open ears. I don't suppose the Israelis did it on their own, even if the Israelis are the ultimate culprits. But we've got a serious problem with corruption and terrorism inside the US state structure. What do you do about that? Well, I don't know. That's another question, isn't it?
Well, he talked about Danny Jewenko in the first clip. He was an engineer, an architect from Holland, who was talking about the actual complexity of trying to rig three massive buildings with explosives to bring them down by controlled demolition.
Well, in other words, the key element here is access. When we had William Rodriguez visiting Britain and Bristol a few years ago, he was the janitor in the World Trade Center. Most people don't realize that the World Trade Center was privatized 6 weeks before the attack, and a whole new set of people were coming in and out who nobody who'd worked in the building for 20 years knew who they were. And the latest technical analysis of what happened, people have found nanothermite in the rubble. This has now been peer-reviewed in all of the chemistry journals by Niels Harrit, and who's from the University of Copenhagen, and Stephen Jones from the University of Utah. Basically, the bottom line here is that somebody had access. Who had access? Well, the people who owned the buildings. And we know who owned the buildings. It was a consortium led by Larry Silverstein, including one Rupert Murdoch Esquire. He was one of the consortium that owned the buildings. And he's been very, very supportive of Israel over the years. His recent troubles have led to all kinds of flurries of support in the Israeli press, because Rupert Murdoch has always been a great supporter of Israel. And a lot of these people, like Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, all of these people, they are super, super, super supporters of Israel. Israel can do no wrong in their eyes, and they're prepared to do virtually anything to help them.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that every single one of Rupert Murdoch's papers was very much supportive of the Iraq war.
Indeed.
Anyway, Alan Zabrowski's from a Jewish family himself, and he's accusing the Jewish state of Israel of the most horrendous crime. So is Zabrowski a self-hating Jew?
My concern is that I don't much care about other people or other countries. I don't hate anyone in particular. I don't like anyone in particular. I'm an American. My loyalty is strictly to the United States. And I don't care what my ethnicity is or what my ancestry is. My allegiance is that. And my concern is only whether something helps or hurts the United States. And I think anyone who's a citizen of any country can very properly have similar feelings toward their country. What I'm concerned about is what is done to hurt America. And it is very clear that over a period of the last 40-odd years, that the penetration of the American political process, the effective subordination of the Congress in particular to Israel, when an Israeli prime minister can get 29 standing ovations from a Congress that can't give that much support to one of their own presidents, no matter how outlandish the statements, you have something as close to a puppet agency as you're going to find. Our policy in the Middle East has for decades been manipulated increasingly in terms of what benefits Israel and not what benefits the United States. Even when that policy is articulated and supported by individuals who are sworn officials of the United States government. And to me, when a sworn official of the United States government, whether or not that person has dual Israeli citizenship, manipulates American policy, contrives crises and tragedies like 9/11, contrives wars like Afghanistan and Iraq, and now tries to get us into a war with Iran, all in the service of Israel, spending American lives in that process, they commit high treason, and they need to be treated in that manner.
It's Alan Zabrowski speaking on Iranian TV channel Press TV on their Autograph program recently. Martin, this whole thing of the US being infiltrated by the Israelis, it does sound rather far-fetched, doesn't it?
Not really. I mean, quite frankly, they're there in plain sight. You talk to any American politician and they'll say that their support for Israel is unbreakable. Obama was saying some similar things not long ago. They boast from the rooftops that Israel can do no wrong, and they support her 100%, either because they're Christians and they believe that the end time is coming and the Israelis are part of their rapture philosophy, or just because they support Israel because they support Israel. The one of the few American politicians who said they didn't support Israel was Cynthia McKinney, who was the congresswoman for Atlanta in Georgia, and she was immediately attacked by the Israeli the Zionist establishment in the US and deselected in her district, even though she was incredibly popular. She's actually in Tripoli in Libya at the moment, or she was last week. Now, the Americans boast about their support for Israel, so in actual fact, when we say that American policy is dominated by the Israelis, it's hardly news, is it? It's not rocket science. It's been dominated by Israeli policy for years and years and years and years and years.
Now, you talk about this whole idea of the sort of Christian right saying that the Israeli state is performing some sort of biblical mission. Now, that's pretty scary, isn't it?
Yes, but I mean, we all know that we've got these rather scary people in the US who are Christians who believe the end of the world is nigh and Israel's going to bring it about, and many of them are elected to Congress and the Senate, which is actually scary. But when you've got senior military officers saying exactly the same sort of thing, that Israel's defence is America's defence, I think it's really fantastic that an American Jewish officer of the stature and the intelligence of Dr. Sabrowski is prepared to call a spade a spade. He's a tribute to his training, he's a tribute to the US military, and he's a tribute to his own Jewish heritage, frankly.
Finally, Press TV's Autograph Show asked former US Marine Corps vet and head of studies at the US Army War College, Alan Zabrowski, why pulling apart the 9/11 attacks is still important today.
I think the first thing to note, and I want to be sure that this is emphasized, is that Jewish nationalism or Zionism is not Judaism. It has nothing to do with Judaism. Many of the Zionists are very secular Jews. They are not practicing Jews in a religious sense. The thing that's intriguing about Zionism, and I think I use the phrase that it's a real witch's brew of xenophobia, ultranationalism, and militarism, with a nice scrap of regional imperialism built into it. Most nationalism is not like that. Most nationalism is intended to be a unifying force, but it doesn't go to such an extreme level. A second element of it is that when you have competing nationalisms, it's very, very rare to find anything that involves the level of antipathy and hatred to the other side.
Well, I think the distinction is between patriotism and nationalism. Patriotism is love of one's country. Nationalism is hatred of other peoples. I think Dr. Sabrowski is a great American patriot.
Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Froom Vale, Leslie Alexander. Also to retired Dr. Chris Burns-Cox and to patient advocate Daphne Havercroft, not forgetting old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, we talk to more eyewitnesses to the Easter disturbances on Stokes Croft. What really happened there? This is Tony Gosling wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. On the internet, you can find us on the BCFM website and all our archives at bcfm.com.